let's just look into God's Word this morning. If you have your Bible with you, turn with me to the second book of Kings. I'm going to be zeroing in on the sixth chapter. And in that sixth chapter, I want us to focus on this thought. It's something that's already been talked about this morning. Ronnie's already given us a great illustration for it this morning. And that is seeing the invisible. Seeing the invisible. You look at the first part of this book. The book opens up with some things about Elijah. It's quite a story in the first chapter. People coming to Elijah because Elijah has ruffled some feathers. He's made some people a little bit upset, or maybe we could just say mad. And they call him a man of God, and he says, if I'm really a man of God, then fire from heaven will come down and consume you. And lo and behold, that happened. Then another captain of 50, and the 50 came and said the same, basically the same thing to him. I think I'd have changed my words. Somewhere I'd have figured something said something different, but they said about the same thing, and he said, if I'm a man of God, then fire is going to come down and consume you, and that's about what happened. Well, then the third group of people, the fifth captain of 50 and his 50 came, and lo and behold, if he didn't change his words, he said, please let me find favor in your sight. Count my life precious to you. Count the lives of my 50 precious to you. Then we come into chapter 2, and here's the story of Elijah and Elisha. What a story it is, as Elijah's taken away and Elisha remains, receives the mantle, receives the double portion as we see it. I don't know the emotion of Elijah. We can't really tell the emotion of Elijah. But if we try to put ourselves with our feelings into what is taking place, we might have a feeling that Elijah is concerned about the future, wondering what the future holds, because his mentor is gone. The one that he's learned off of, the one that he's followed, the one that he's spent so much time with and he's looked up to is gone. I have his mantle. It's of value to me. It may not be of any value to anybody else, but it's of value to me. And he's going on with a little bit of apprehension, of uncertainty as to what takes place. Within that chapter, you'll see that there's a group of kids that come out and begin to mock him. I don't know what's going through the mind of a person to say what caused him to say what he says about these children. Not for sure exactly how many children there were. We know that there were 42 of them that were torn by the beasts. The bears coming out and it says it tore them and tear 42 children of them. What a story unfolding here of God's protection and God's divine intervention in a person's life. In the midst of uncertainties and in the midst of perceived chaos. Now, I'm not trying to minimize chaos and just simply call it perceived, but you see, our perceptions have a lot to do with what's taking place around us. There may not be anything really seriously going on, but because of our perception, because of the way we picture it, the way we see it, or the way we feel it, we become overwhelmed by circumstances. Quite often, or sometimes at least, it's because of our perception rather than by reality. these children weren't bothering him, were they? I don't know, but there's the perception there. And God intervenes. And, you know, we can argue and people can argue about why and the wherefores and all of that stuff. But the picture's unfolding here of God seeing after and looking after Elijah. And he's with Elijah and he's giving Elijah the feeling, or at least it ought to be there, that God is standing with him. Chapter 3 unfolds. We don't see a whole lot in here of what's going on in the life of Elisha. We see a little bit, but it's nothing major that's taking place, I don't guess. But then chapter 4, it tells us some more things that's going on. There's the widow with two sons, and Elisha is a key part. And then there's the Shunammite woman who's wanting a son. And of course, the story's broader, it's bigger than what that is. The Shunammite woman takes care of Elisha's needs, and her husband provide for him in the circumstances that would bring him their direction. And then Elisha says, "What is it that you want? Is there something that you desire? You want me to talk to the authorities? Do you want me to talk to the king on your behalf?" And the woman says, I just really want a son." And so Elisha says, "With the proper time frame, the proper occurrence of life, you will be embracing a son." Man of God, don't mock me. Don't lie to me. Don't deceive me here. Is it really to be so? And yes, the pattern of life. God's not going to do anything out of the ordinary and say that you're going to have a full-term child in 3 months, but the pattern, the norm, you will embrace a son. Oh, what excitement that was there in that story. And then the child grows and then it dies. And the woman goes to Elisha. And in her faith, she tells the servant of Elisha that all is well. My husband, myself, and my son. But Elisha, I want you to come. I ask you not to deceive me, would you? And Elisha realized what was taking place. Elisha went back and he saw that son lived again, was awakened. What a beautiful story, beautiful ending to a story. It was great. Everyone lived happily ever after. Chapter 5. It begins to talk to us about another circumstance or another story. And this one here perhaps is even bigger. There's a leprous man high up in the ranks. You know the story. Do we need to spend very much time reiterating the story? Go dip. Oh, we've got better places than that. I don't really want to do that. All of the things involved, even spending time looking at this particular little girl or young lady who was in the home, who God planted there. God planted there in the midst of not so pleasant circumstances. Can we see it that way? Can we understand it that way? That's what it was? Took a little maid out of the land of Israel, took her captive, and she waited on Naaman's wife. She became a slave, a servant. That doesn't sound too wonderful of circumstances to me, does it to you? But she was the one that was used as an instrument of God to bring about a recognition to the entire country. Not just to Naaman and his wife, but to the entire country. Because Naaman was high up, and his leprosy was known, and his healing was therefore known. And it comes back to this one little lady, this one young maid who brought about the information to Naaman and his wife that they needed that God's name would be recognized. You know, there's a story in itself right there that can infiltrate our lives personally, wondering about our circumstances. God may use something small and insignificant in our life to make His name significant. Can we pause for a moment this morning and say, Am I willing to be that? Knowing that in the midst of that story here, there's captivity or there's less than desirable circumstances that surround the key person. That you and I may be called upon to deal with something that is less than desirable, but through it, God can be made visible. That story doesn't end entirely on a beautiful note. Now I know that Naaman and his family are excited and they live happily ever after. You know, they're excited about what's taking place. But in the life of Elisha here, boy, what is it that happens? What is going on with Gehazi here? He's seen all these things that God has done and the protection on Elisha, but a little seed of greed destroys him. It's almost strange to believe that this man who has seen God work, how would it be for you to walk with Elisha and see all of these things that has taken place? How would it be for me to watch God move in miraculous ways time and time again and be fresh from the healing of Naaman? For Gehazi to allow that seed of greed to literally destroy him. Isn't that an astounding thought when you think about it? When you allow that to penetrate, then we jump over here quickly. That story ends and Gehazi has received the leprous condition of Naaman. We jump over into chapter 6. And Elisha is, again, a person who brings about something that is unbelievable. If I were to tell you that that happened to me, you would say, wait a minute, preacher, what have you been doing? Where? Your mind's slipping. An axe head floated. How many of you have ever seen metal float on its own? An axe head floated. I don't know, it just seems a little bit out of the ordinary to me. Just a little bit out of the ordinary. But that's what we see taking place. God is once again making himself visible through his servant Elisha. Then in verse number 8 of this chapter, the story shifts again and we see that Elisha is now in a different circumstance. Syria is warred against Israel. The king of Syria warred against Israel. And he's taken up counsel with his servants. Now I love this story. This is a great story to me. Not that the axe head floating is not. That is interesting. That is exciting. I can imagine being there and watching that happen, how our eyes would bug out just like theirs, big as saucers. I imagine that that's what. But this story, it just intrigues me, I guess because of the military side of it. Even though I've never been a military person, it just intrigues me to see what is taking place. Because here they are planning their war, planning their attack, and somehow somebody has leaked the information to the enemy and thwarted their attempts. Not once. As a matter of fact, it says not once nor twice. So it would indicate that it was more than two times. That somebody, now I'm telling you that if you or I were the king or the captain of that military force that had somebody leaking information away from us, that we would really be raising some eyebrows. We'd be doing something about it, just like what's taking place here. Who is it? Name the person that is doing this. And the answer comes back to him, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha. Elisha, the prophet that is in Israel, telleth the king of Israel the words that thou speakest in thy bedchamber. I'm flabbergasted. He knows what I've said in the privacy of my bedchamber? Something's got to be done about this guy. We cannot win. We will not make it. I will not survive unless something is done with this fella. Let's find out. Let's spy. Let's locate him. Try to figure out what's going on, how to get a hold of him. And he said, let's fetch him. We've got to take him down. Apparently, the king of Syria didn't understand that Elisha wasn't just Elisha. Elisha was the servant of God. And that if Elisha knew what he said in his bedchamber about the plan for warfare, that Elisha also was going to know that they were going to come after him and how they were going to come after him. The king is beside himself with emotion here, and it is destroying his sense of reality. That happens to so many people. We get wrapped up in the emotion of our circumstances, and we fail to realize the reality that is surrounding these circumstances. We can get caught up in what we feel is bad and what we see is bad, and we fail to realize that there's a God behind all of these things that we see and feel or perceive as bad. And he did it. He did exactly that. He got wrapped up in the emotion of it, thinking, well, let's go fetch him. Let's spy on him, as though spying on him is going to thwart his plan and his knowledge of what we're doing. Elisha just went along with the whole thing. Let's go get him. And Elisha just, could I say it this way? Without really knowing Elisha, I've never met him, I've never shaken his hand, you know, I haven't spent time with Elisha, but I could say it this way, that Elisha just simply said to himself, I'm going to follow God no matter. I know the enemy doesn't like what I'm doing. I know that there's opposition to the plan. I know that people don't like me following God like I'm following God, but I'm just going to follow him anyway. So the king of Syria sends his people out, and they find out where he is. What is it? The name of the place, isn't it like Dothan or something? You can see it there. Yeah, in verse number 13, behold, he is in Dothan. So they go out with their horses and their chariots. What, it's such a spy campaign here. Horses and chariots and a great host. Well, that's just sensible there. Maybe it was. Doesn't seem like it to me. Well, at least they came by night. That's a good thing. They didn't have street lights and spotlights and all of that stuff. So maybe that was a benefit to them. And they circled. They compassed the city. They surrounded it. They put a siege on. We're going to get this guy. He is not getting away. Verse number 14. This is where I want to look this morning in these next few verses. Seeing the invisible. But in verse number 14, what we realize here is the threatening circumstances. The threatening circumstances, could I reiterate it this way and say that the threatening circumstances surrounded him. There was no way out. You say, well, God doesn't bring anything more on me than what I'm able to bear, and He provides a way of escape if it's more than. This was giving the appearance that there was no way of escape. Now, I'm wanting you to get a hold of this morning because it's the appearance. I have no way to escape. There is no avenue out. I am stuck in my threatening circumstances. Maybe your threatening circumstances are dark clouds of discouragement. The dark clouds of discouragement envelop and surround and pull you down and try to destroy you with the appearance that all is lost. Maybe it's not the dark clouds of discouragement, but maybe it's waves of trouble, you know, wave after wave of trouble. Maybe not today, but tomorrow or next week or next month or some other time, but wave after wave of trouble. Darkening the horizon, discouraging the heart and depressing the mind and the soul. There's no way out. The threatening circumstances have completely surrounded you. Maybe it's the fires of adversity. That is encamped around. The enemy's encampment. Threatening circumstances that were surrounding them. You see it in verse number 14. They were completely surrounded by these horses and chariots, a great host. It was impossible to get away. Samson wasn't on the scene. He couldn't just pick the gates of the city and take them onto his shoulder and carry them to the hill and by doing so frighten his enemies. That wasn't going to be the case. Can you nail it this morning? Sometimes we think that if I do this and if I do that, that God will do it this way. But God doesn't always use the same circumstances to come about with what He wants to do. Samson wasn't going to do his big thing here. God had another plan, even though the circumstances seem to be impossible and threatening. The next verse takes us on beyond the threatening circumstances to something that perhaps you and I can feel, because we see in verse number 15 that here is the fear of the servant. The fear of the servant. Now, I can put myself in his shoes, I believe, more than what I can in Elisha's shoes. I don't know if this servant thought that these people were encamping around about the city for him or not. But I can say for myself that if I were to come out of the city of Dothan and find that the place is completely surrounded by a host of military might, the Syrian army, whether I thought they were for me or not, it would bring me at least a tinge of fear. Just like when you're driving down the road and a cop pulls out behind you. Even though you knew that you weren't doing anything wrong, maybe you don't feel that way, but I do. I know I wasn't speeding. I know I used my turning signal. I know I wasn't doing anything wrong, but if a cop pulls in behind me, there's just something about me, I guess. Got the cruise set at 65 and the speed limit 65. I still hit the cancel button. I don't want to hit the brake because that just kind of tells him that there's guilt. But I hit the cancel button. And then I look down and say, well, I wasn't speeding. Why did I do that? There's a measure of fear that's involved with certain things of our circumstances. What would it be like to come out of the city of Dothan and have this military force, whether I believed they were there for me or not, I believe that I would have at least a little tinge of fear, a little bit of being startled. Having that kind of a thought about fear and what I would do Can I put some personal emotion? You can put personal emotion into the statement of this servant to Elisha in the last phrase of verse 15. He says, "Alas, my master." Maybe his voice is quivering. Maybe he's crying. How shall we do? What are we going to do? What's the plan? Elisha, have you heard? Have you heard from God this morning? Because I'm scared. I'm scared. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how to get out of this. I don't know where we're going. I can't see God's hand in this. Elisha, have you heard from God today? You been there? Maybe you're there. The fear of the servant is found very visible in verse number 15 as we put ourselves with our emotion into it. Verse number 16. What a transformation from 15 and the fear that is in the heart of the servant. We come to verse number 16 and we'll see the faith of Elisha. He simply believed God, didn't he? Here's where it fits. Even when I can't trace his hand, I trust his heart. The writer there wrote in the chorus, "God is too wise to be mistaken. God is too good to be unkind." So when you don't understand, when you don't see his plan, when you can't trace his hand, trust his heart. May we be able to live in such a way that the faith of Elisha, knowing what God has already accomplished, believing what God has already done, trusting in God's continued help, even in the face of certain circumstances that are surrounding me, that God has a plan. I can't trace his hand, but I can trust his heart. The faith of Elisha. That brings us to verse number 17. And in verse number 17, now the threatening circumstances are still there. The fear of the servant is still there, the faith of Elisha is there. In verse number 17, we see the unveiled eyes. What that fearful servant couldn't see became visible to him. What was it? Look at it in verse 17. And Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full. Excuse me, did I read that? The mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. When I can't see or can't trace his hand, I trust his heart. When I can't see the mountains around with chariots abound, I can still trust alone in thee. What an incredible picture of the possibility for you and I to see the invisible. Not with our naked eye, not with a vision that is human, but with a vision that is of faith, believing God has led me thus far. God has been faithful thus far. Oh my, what a testimony this morning of Sister Ruth of God's faithfulness. And from that, the anticipation of what is yet to come. Not fear. Oh, I don't know about tomorrow. I'm anticipating with eager anticipation what God has in store for me. The seeing the invisible. Our eyes that were once veiled can be unveiled to where we can see Jesus, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. David said in Psalm 7, verse 1, O my Lord, or O Lord my God, in thee do I put my trust. And then there's that beautiful psalm that so many of us hang on to, he that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in him will I trust. There's a whole bunch of stuff in that chapter, in that division, that you can hang on to. But right there is the key to the entire subject. In thee will I trust. It's not a matter of seeing the axe head floating, or what God did for the widow woman with her two sons, or the Shunammite woman and her son, or all of these things that are portrayed to us in these chapters leading up to this story. All of that may help give a glimpse into the overwhelming hand and the protection of God and support and give strength and help. But the bottom line comes right back down to this, that when we trust in God in the face of certain adversity or in the face of circumstances that completely compass us around or surround us, that we and trust, seeing the invisible means that I trust his hand. I follow him. I trust his heart. He leads me. We don't know what this year holds, just like we didn't know what last year held. But we can trust our Redeemer. Let's stand together this morning. Songwriter said, I know in whom I have believed. Another songwriter said, there's more with us than be with them. You see, it comes from a heart of trust, belief, allowing the eye of faith to see what my eye cannot and follow him. Praise God. Is every heart clear this morning? Anybody need to pray? Let's go today rejoicing in God's abiding presence and his help. Trusting in him. Luke Tedrow, would you dismiss us in prayer?